Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Ending Mass Incarceration, Why It Persists, and How to Achieve Meaningful Reform by Catherine Beckett. Narrated by Wendy Tremont King. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to figures and tables present in the print and ebook formats of the book. 1. Introduction. As I write these words, at the close of 2020, over 10 million people living in the United States have been sickened with COVID-19. Nearly 500,000 have died as a result, and many of those who were hospitalized are now contending with long-term health challenges and massive medical debt. Video-recorded evidence of police killings and near-killings of black men, including most recently George Floyd, Jacob Blake, and Daniel Prude, continue to emerge at a regular and heartbreaking pace. Democracy and the right to vote are under assault. Millions of people are unemployed. Evictions are on the rise and are expected to become even more common. Recently, the western United States was ablaze. Millions of residents were smothered under toxic air for months, and tens of thousands were evacuated. The events of 2020 have made it abundantly clear that public safety is inextricably bound up with health and welfare. Yet, this capacious understanding of public safety is at odds with popular usage of the term. For decades, conservative political actors have argued that there is just one significant threat to public safety: interpersonal violence, and that the restoration of tough criminal penalties was the only appropriate response to this problem. This emphasis intensified in the 1960s and 1970s, as conservatives argued that government responsibility for public safety required nothing more than a muscular state response to so-called street crime. As many observers have pointed out, these calls for law and order treated protest against racial inequality as a form of violence, and were part of an effort to discredit the civil and welfare rights movements, just as President Donald Trump's donning of the law and order mantle in the summer of 2020 was a clear rejoinder to the Black Lives Matter movement. Calls for law and order were also a component of a larger struggle over the proper role of government in economic affairs. Throughout this period, conservatives argued that it is not the government's responsibility to provide for the public welfare. Some even made the argument that welfare causes crime. It is no coincidence that in 1964, the same year that President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, and in the context of the war on poverty, Republican presidential candidate Barry Goldwater relied heavily on the rhetoric of law and order. Those who mobilized this rhetoric not only emphasized the threat of street crime and conflated protest with violence, they also emphasized government's role in maintaining a free economy and invoked racist images of welfare queens to delegitimize the movement to expand welfare rights. This political strategy has, for decades, been a useful way of tapping into the racial biases and stereotypes that are inextricably bound up with attitudes about crime, punishment, and poverty in the United States. In fact, racially charged rhetoric about crime and punishment and welfare was key to this effort to woo socially conservative white voters to the GOP. This use of such subliminal racial appeals and coded racial rhetoric remains a powerful means of tapping into racial resentments for electoral benefit, particularly among those in the electorate who were prioritized in the wake of partisan realignment. This strategy continues to be central to Republican Party operations. For example, despite broad popular support for deferred action for childhood arrivals and opposition to construction of a border wall, GOP candidates relied heavily on racially charged immigration-related rhetoric in the run-up to the 2018 midterm elections in an attempt to secure the votes of electorally crucial and socially conservative white voters. Similarly, on the eve of the 2020 presidential election, the Trump campaign issued numerous calls for law and order in an attempt to capitalize on racial tensions and in a desperate bid to shift attention from his disastrous handling of the pandemic and its economic and social consequences. Unfortunately, this impoverished understanding of public safety has gained a strong toehold in our increasingly fragile and fractured democracy, to the point that justice is often presumed to be synonymous with tough punishment. Over the years, and particularly in the 1990s, many liberal lawmakers also came to support this tough crime talk and policy. The results of this political convergence are well known, and include the widespread adoption of policies that created the largest prison population the world has ever known. Spending on courts and corrections increased notably, and the number of people under the supervision of the criminal legal system increased more than fivefold, while the safety net became more porous. The United States has been the world's leading jailer for many years now. It is also characterized by extraordinarily high levels of poverty and inequality compared to other wealthy nations. The increased reach of the U.S. criminal legal system has been so profound and so consequential that researchers now treat penal institutions as a key mechanism by which social inequality is reproduced over time. But the problem is not only a matter of scale. At its core, mass incarceration reflects the tenuousness of our commitment to racial equity, to human rights, and to social justice. It is also testament to our reluctance to recognize the innumerable ways that violence has shaped our country, our people, and our way of doing justice. It is in this context that calls to reimagine public safety from Black Lives Matter activists have resounded across the country. Redefining public safety. The narrow understanding of public safety just described artificially separates public welfare, public health, and public safety. It also rests on the erroneous assumption that interpersonal violence is the preeminent threat to safety, and the only kind of threat to which governments are compelled to respond. Assault, robbery, and other violent crimes do undermine public health and well-being, and the risk of these types of violence remains unacceptably high in disadvantaged urban neighborhoods, despite recent drops in national crime rates. Sadly, current policies do little to reduce these kinds of harms. Moreover, other equally serious threats to safety, health, and well-being are also pervasive, especially in marginalized communities. These include past and present discrimination, high levels of poverty and extreme poverty, pervasive housing instability and homelessness, limited access to health care, police harassment and violence, unsafe water and air, mass incarceration, global pandemics, the climate crisis, and for non-citizens, the risk of family separation and deportation. Recognition of the varied nature of these threats to our well-being necessitates a broader understanding of the meaning of public safety. To feel and be safe, people need not only to be protected from interpersonal violence and other crimes, but also to know that they will not be killed by the police, and that the government is doing what it can to address the threat of climate change. They must have access to housing, and health care and be free from harassment and discrimination. This more capacious understanding of public safety recognizes that investments in public health, health care, education, child care, substance abuse treatment, green energy and technology, and housing are simultaneously investments in public welfare, public health, and public safety. From this broader perspective, poverty is itself a form of violence. It entails various forms of psychological and physical deprivation that impair health and well-being. It also fuels interpersonal violence, because families living in poverty contend with a variety of structural and contextual challenges that are consistently associated with higher levels of crime and violence. Given this association of poverty with interpersonal violence, it is unsurprising that investments in social and child welfare not only improve people's quality of life, but also reduce crime and violence. In short, a thin conception of public safety that focuses only on freedom from street crime obscures the fact that many people, and especially people of color, people living in poverty, undocumented immigrants, and disabled people, contend with numerous and often overlapping threats to personal safety. It also ignores evidence that some of these other threats to well-being and safety fuel interpersonal violence, and relatedly, that investments in public welfare and public health reduce crime and violence. By contrast, a thick conception of public safety recognizes the wide array of social conditions that undermine safety and well-being, and prioritizes the health and well-being of all members of the public, including the incarcerated. Despite the increasingly visible and obvious array of threats to public health and safety that were on full display throughout the pandemic, the idea that harsh criminal penalties represent a meaningful way of addressing and ensuring public safety has become common sense for many Americans. In addition to erroneously assuming that crime is the only significant threat to our safety, this approach rests on the misleading premise that the tough policies that fueled mass incarceration effectively reduce crime. This is inaccurate. In fact, harsh penalties do not deter crime and violence more effectively than less severe sanctions. Long and life sentences are an inefficient, inhumane, and ineffective way of reducing crime. And many societies with less draconian criminal penalties enjoy comparatively low rates of crime. As is discussed throughout this book, it is simply untrue that tough anti-crime policies keep us safe. In fact, it has become abundantly clear that mass incarceration itself constitutes a threat to public safety and health. Mass incarceration as a threat to public health and safety. Critics on both the left and the right use the term mass incarceration to call attention to the unprecedented scale of the U.S. criminal legal system and racial inequities in it, and the havoc they wreak. The U.S. incarceration rate began an unprecedented ascent in the 1970s. This trend continued through 2007, when nearly 1 in 100 adults lived behind bars. 5 million others were on probation or parole. Roughly 10 million spent time in jail, and nearly 1 in 3, between 70 and 100 million people, were living with a criminal record. Immigrant detention has also increased dramatically. On an average day in 2020, nearly 50,000 immigrants were detained in the United States, up from a few thousand in 1980. The scale of confinement sharply differentiates the United States from comparable democratic countries. where incarceration rates range from 38 per 100,000 residents in Japan to 188 per 100,000 in New Zealand. By contrast, the U.S. incarceration rate remains remarkably high, at 644 per 100,000 residents in 2020. The United States is the world's leading jailer, and has been for some time now. In 2001, the legal scholar David Garland coined the term mass imprisonment to call attention to the unprecedented expansion of prison populations in the United States, and to racial inequities in it, including the systematic imprisonment of whole groups of the population. Since that time, the use of the similar term, mass incarceration, which also includes the jail population, has exploded. Much of the literature that explores mass incarceration's causes and consequences pays particular attention to the tail end of the criminal legal process, namely incarceration, and to the policy developments that have fueled the use of prison and jail. This extensive body of research shows that mass incarceration has had far-reaching effects that work to enhance and mask racial and economic inequalities. For the formerly incarcerated, these effects include reduced earnings and employment, increased housing instability and indebtedness, and impaired physical health and mental well-being. Criminal legal system involvement undermines the life chances not only of those who experience incarceration, but their families and loved ones as well. Given pronounced racial and ethnic disparities in criminal legal system involvement, families and communities of color have been especially hard hit. One recent study, for example, found that nearly half of all black women have a family member in prison. As Garland notes, studies that focus on the causes and consequences of mass incarceration are distinct from efforts to trace all of the forms in which state power is exercised through the criminal justice apparatus. Studies aimed at this broader objective often use the terms carceral state or mass criminalization to call attention to the expanding role of police and criminal legal institutions, broadly defined, in communities of color and in the lives of people contending with poverty. This broader conception of the problem is bolstered by the fact that while roughly 2 million U.S. residents live behind bars, more than 4 million are on probation or parole, and tens of millions who have completed their criminal sentence remain saddled with debilitating criminal records and oppressive legal debt. It has become abundantly clear that aggressive policing and non-confinement-based forms of criminal legal supervision, including increasingly electronic home monitoring, also cause significant harm by imposing a vast array of burdensome rules and restrictions, enhancing debt, and generally failing to assist people as they seek to stabilize their lives. Yet, even a focus on all forms of criminal legal supervision captures just the tip of the criminal justice iceberg. Contact with the criminal legal system often has destabilizing and debilitating effects, even if people are never convicted or sentenced to jail or prison. For example, sociologist Diva Pager's seminal work reveals that low-level felony convictions, even absent evidence of incarceration or criminal legal supervision, reduce job applicants' prospects. The effect of the mark of a criminal record interacts with and is compounded by racial discrimination to enhance inequality over time. Similarly, other sociological studies indicate that people who are stopped, frisked, arrested, fined, and surveilled are harmed by their contact with police in the criminal legal system, even if they are neither convicted nor confined. For example, aggressive policing adversely affects the health and well-being of targeted individuals and communities. In fact, living in neighborhoods where the police rely heavily on stop and frisk and similar techniques amplifies psychological distress and undermines the well-being of male residents, including those who are not stopped by the police. Arrest and the involvement with the lower court system that it often triggers can be enormously time-consuming and create a variety of burdens, including reporting and program requirements, fines, and more. Even where misdemeanor courts depend on high dismissal rates to manage large caseloads, and where conviction is relatively uncommon, arrest and court involvement can be quite exacting. Criminal legal system contact and surveillance have adverse effects on people's lives, not only because they lead to punishment, but also because they impact residents' everyday lives, including the routes they travel, the institutions they can access or must avoid, the balance of power in their personal relationships, their financial resources, and more, in consistently unhelpful ways. The presence of the police in hospital emergency rooms, for example, induces some people who have had contact with the criminal legal system to leave the hospital without receiving treatment, a pattern that likely reproduces health inequalities over time. Similarly, people who have had any form of contact with the criminal legal system are significantly less likely to interact with organizations that engage in formal record-keeping, such as medical, financial, labor market, and educational institutions, than people who have not. Insofar as access to these institutions is an important means by which people improve their quality of life and achieve upward mobility, this system avoidance may be an important mechanism by which the criminal legal system reproduces social inequality over time. The dramatic uptick in the assessment of legal financial obligations further illustrates how contact with the criminal legal system can adversely affect people and exacerbate inequality even when conviction and incarceration do not occur. The imposition of fees, fines, and other legal obligations has increased notably as courts and other criminal legal institutions struggle to fund their expanded operations. This trend, combined with the increase in the number of people who are convicted, means that millions of overwhelmingly poor people now carry legal debt. In fact, many people who have never been convicted also carry the burden of legal debt. For example, a recent study in Alabama found that fines imposed on people who were arrested but not convicted of a misdemeanor offense or traffic violation outstrip those imposed on people convicted of a felony offense. Similarly, parents are charged for the cost of their children's detention in at least 19 states and in numerous counties. In short, while confinement in jail or prison is especially harmful, some of the negative effects of the criminal legal system do not depend on incarceration or even conviction. At the same time, the increased reach of the criminal legal system means that a variety of control-oriented institutions, including court supervision programs, probation, and parole, play a significant and often harmful role in the everyday lives of people who are poor. For these reasons, some scholars and advocates use the term carceral state to highlight the expanded power and reach of criminal legal institutions. The term mass criminalization similarly underscores the fact that aggressive policing and incarceration are our default tools for dealing with a wide array of social problems that can and should be solved by other means, as advocate and writer Deborah Small notes. Although it is clear that Criminal legal institutions can and do create significant harm, even in the absence of incarceration. I use the more familiar term, mass incarceration, throughout this book, to refer to the broad expansion of the state social control apparatus, and the myriad ways in which it penetrates and shapes the lives of far too many people in the contemporary United States. If mass incarceration made us safer, weighing the harm it causes against its public safety benefits would be a tricky business. But mass incarceration does not make us safer. Although the policies and practices that have fueled the expansion of the criminal legal system are routinely justified as crime-fighting measures, mass incarceration is a short-sighted, ineffective, costly, and inhumane approach to public safety. Many countries, with far lower incarceration rates, experience far less crime and have enjoyed declines in crime rates similar to those that have taken place in the United States. U.S. states that decreased their imprisonment rates the most in recent years have enjoyed the largest drops in crime rates. Research further shows that short sentences deter as much as long ones, and that the vast majority of people age out of crime. In fact, incarceration is often criminogenic, actually causing crime. For these and other reasons, the National Research Council recently concluded that statutes mandating lengthy prison sentences cannot be justified on the basis of their effectiveness in preventing crime. Mass incarceration and criminal justice reform in 21st century America. While mass incarceration persists and carceral state power remains robust, notable shifts have occurred in the criminal legal landscape. 20 or 30 years ago, criticizing harsh sentencing policies would have been political suicide for elected officials. Today, many politicians express concern about the expansion of prison and jail populations. Perhaps most surprising, after years of advocating tough approaches to crime and drugs, some conservatives have come to believe that prisons and jails have grown too large. In fact, political scientists David Dagan and Stephen Tellis attribute the recent increase in state-level reform measures to the mobilization of conservative critics of mass incarceration, who tied what had been a handful of scattered state-level reforms into a broader narrative that cast decarceration as a matter of conservative principle, then marshaled their political networks to spread the message, and plotted strategic initiatives at the state and federal levels to bring around potential allies. For Dagan and Tellis, the significance of these developments lies not only in the novelty of conservatives' revised position and their ability to capitalize on the Nixon goes to China dynamic, but also in the role that conservatives play in presenting evidence of mass incarceration's costs to other conservatives, thereby spreading the new gospel. Indeed, Dagan and Tellis suggest that this process was so effective that criminal justice reform has become the new conservative orthodoxy. While the election of Trump to the presidency in 2016 cast doubt on this thesis, it is clear that the politics surrounding the issue have shifted, and not only among conservatives. In 2020, many Democratic presidential candidates, including Joe Biden, fought to position themselves as more progressive on criminal justice issues than their competitors, and to distance themselves from their prior statements and actions on related issues. A notable shift in media discourse has also occurred. In the 1980s and 1990s, news stories about crime and punishment were ubiquitous, and often framed crime as a consequence of the failure of the criminal legal system to punish adequately. These stories often suggested criminals escaped punishment because of legal technicalities.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?